This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ranchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this rather frigid but clear Saturday morning here in Connecticut. And today's show, we're going to be chatting about a lot of topics, but I have a very interesting guest coming on, Dr. Justin Daddario. Dr. Daddario is a vascular surgeon, and he's going to talk to us a lot about vascular disease. You know, when we think about vascular disease, we think about serious conditions like heart attack and stroke. But there are so many people who are out there suffering from peripheral vascular disease, things that affect the blood vessels going to your legs, your arms, and the factors that cause them to not work well. We're going to talk about the symptoms that people experience. But the reason I wanted to have Dr. Daddario on is he's a very young physician who is bringing to our community some new techniques, especially when trying to do intravascular things that are what we call minimally invasive. Not these procedures where we have to leave huge scars on people to reroute blood vessels. So he's going to chat with us about that. He's at the University of Connecticut, where he works as a vascular surgeon. So looking forward to our conversation with him. This day in medicine, January 20th, 1580. So we're going way back on this one. Dr. Samuel Fuller was born. And in 1620, he was a passenger who made the voyage on the Mayflower. He was the only physician on that group. And, you know, from 1620 to 1621, half of all the passengers who were on the Mayflower died in Plymouth when they got there. And it was such a tough winter. If you ever get a chance to read about the whole adventure of coming here, and it's interesting because these are folks who were looking for religious freedom and came to America, and really it talks a lot about his relationship with his family and then them eventually coming over to America. So these early Americans who came here really seeking freedom for their religion and the oppression they were receiving back in England. So it's very interesting from that standpoint. It's also interesting to see how from 1620 to now, really over the last 600 years, we're still doing the same thing and providing a place for people to come to for whether it be religious freedom or other freedom or just coming to democracy, and how important it is for us to protect that democracy. Last week, I did an interview on the air with Ann Nyberg. Many of you know her. She's a very popular TV host. And the topic was winter sports and head injuries. And I thought it was worth chatting about on this program. You know, one of the questions is, what is TBI? I mean, TBI, traumatic brain injury, is such a wide spectrum of things, right? So the most severe being penetrating trauma, the injuries we see from war, and obviously the most mild being a concussion. And concussion is such a vague term. I always often tell people that when I was in medical school and residency, I never heard the term concussion because it's so ill-defined. But essentially, it's become known as a mild traumatic brain injury. Now, in winter sports, there are about 20,000 brain injuries related to winter sports every year. And when we think about it, right, we think about sports like ice skating, ice hockey, skiing, snowmobiling, snowboarding. And those of us who are old enough to remember, we didn't wear helmets when we were skiing. It really is something that developed as we became more aware of the injuries. And these are high-velocity injuries and can result in death and has resulted in death in many situations. One of the things that brought things to light was in 2009 when Natasha Richardson, many of you will remember, she's an actress who was married to Liam Neeson. At the time, she was skiing in Canada with her family and fell, hit her head on the snow, and back then was not wearing a helmet. And basically, she had an intense headache that gradually improved. She was evaluated by the ski patrol. They brought her down, and they recommended that she go by ambulance to the local hospital. She felt that she was getting better and didn't need to do that. And in fact, the ambulance actually came, and she refused to go with the ambulance. And what happened was later on in the evening, she went back to the condominium, and the headache intensified. She became confused and passed away from what's called an epidural hematoma. This is a small artery, the middle meningeal artery, that bleeds from trauma. And it has what we call this clear period where, and this is what every sports physician is panicked about. This is our nightmare, is you see an athlete, they're getting better, they get completely better, and then decline quickly within a period of a few hours. And that's what happened here, and she passed away from that. So, again, what we've learned is helmets. I think there are a lot of ski areas. I rarely see somebody without a helmet, to be honest with you. They're, first of all, they're practical. They keep your head warm. They keep your head dry. And they protect your brain. So there's no reason not to be wearing one. And I think they're required at most places, especially with a sport like snowboarding. But the other thing is to really listen to the people around you who may know better. These ski patrol people, whether they be physicians or just patrollers, they see a lot of these injuries. They have experience. If they're recommending to do something, do it. Really, don't try to be your own person here. And I think that's very important from that standpoint, is pay attention to the people who know more than you do. Now, for many of us, our sport has become walking, right? You develop a regular walking regimen that you obviously want to stick with, even though it's winter, right? Even though you're dealing with cold weather and ice, and especially this past week, there's so much black ice out there. You really have to be careful how you're walking. So I understand people want to keep their regimen going and get out there. But there are things you have to do. First of all, you have to dress extremely warmly so you don't get frostbite. But the slip and falls are the ones that keep emergency rooms busy, right? Head injuries, broken hips, broken arms and wrists. One way to possibly avoid that is a small investment in some of these things. They look like ski chains that you put on your shoes. There are various ones. Some of them look like springs. I mean, you put them on over your sneakers, your shoes, whatever you are comfortable in walking. And you just strap them on and you use them to walk because they, even on ice, they dig in. They will give you tremendous traction. So if you really want to keep your regimen going, you would invest in something like this to avoid potential tragedy. And this is especially true for older athletes. A lot of people think, well, I'm old, I don't need to do this. As we get older, and I include myself in that group, we certainly need to be a little bit more cautious around ice and snow and when participating in high-velocity sports such as this. Last week, I had the opportunity to see that my grandson is now playing indoor flag football. And I was pleasantly surprised that they wear headgear. Now, they don't wear helmets. And I have to explain to you that also we find that helmets in very young children are really an encumbrance because their necks aren't that strong to hold that helmet on their head. That's why we advocate a great deal for flag football in young children rather than tackle football. The helmet puts a lot of strain on a young person's neck, and when they're hit, they can easily develop a whiplash type of injury. So this type of headgear he was wearing was mandatory for all the players. It's more of a headband with cushioning primarily on the back of the head. Now you might say, well, why the back of the head? Is because they're playing indoors on artificial turf. And we've learned from the NFL and especially quarterbacks when they're hit and fall back and strike the back of their head. So this seemed like a very lightweight, well-designed, and inexpensive piece of headgear that young people can wear when they're participating in sports such as this. So it's something that I wasn't necessarily aware of and was happy to see. There was a recent controversy in the boxing world. Now, many of you may not have heard this, but and I'll leave the names out because I think it's important from the standpoint that there was a fight in Las Vegas recently. And the referee, well, it was felt that there was a controversy whether an athlete, a fighter, had a cerebral aneurysm. And apparently, two physicians who reviewed the studies felt that there was evidence of an intracerebral aneurysm and that it was unsafe for this fighter to participate in a boxing event. Another physician was called in, and I don't know the specialties of these physicians or who they were, but this physician said that that was not an aneurysm and that he should be allowed to fight. So they allowed the fight to go on. The referee somehow became knowledgeable of this situation, that this athlete may have an aneurysm, may be at risk of dying. If you ever talk to a referee who had to referee a fight where a fighter died, it is life-changing. It is a tremendous area of sadness and mourning for them as well. So this referee, in the first round of the fight, when the fighter who he felt shouldn't be there was getting battered to some degree, he ended the fight. And this set off a huge controversy, especially since he also made it known, this medical information. The point here is, first of all, with an aneurysm, sometimes it's not an aneurysm. It could be very deceptive based on the studies you do. Sometimes you'll see a bend in an artery that looks like an intracerebral aneurysm, and it's not. I'm not going to get into the particulars of it, but for whatever reason, if there's a question that there may be a brain abnormality, I have a low threshold for not letting it fight, and that's how we are in Connecticut. We end a lot of fights before they ever start, and maybe some of them wrongly so, but from the standpoint that if there's ever a question about safety in a sport that could lead to an athlete's death, you have a very low threshold. And that's the way I hope it always stays here in Connecticut. We're going to take a short break. Now we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Justin Daddario. We're going to be talking about vascular disease. If you need to reach me, you can reach out to me at info@alessimd.com, and we'll take your question and pose them to Dr. Daddario. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it gives me great pleasure to have as my guest today Dr. Justin Daddario. Dr. Daddario is a vascular surgeon. He's on the faculty at the University of Connecticut where he operates. He is an assistant professor of surgery at the university, specializing in vascular surgery and endovascular surgery. And he is one of our newer, younger physicians who brings with him new technology to our community. Justin, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit. Just go over some of your background, your education, training, what goes into becoming a vascular surgeon.
Yeah, so I am a New England guy, state institution through and through, starting in New York with undergraduate and then med school down on Long Island. I trained in vascular surgery out in the Midwest, eventually relocated here to help folks in a community I grew up in. You know, now, as far as becoming a vascular surgeon, you have to have a pretty good deal of humility, you know, in my opinion, and a strong work ethic as many surgeons. But the reason being is that this disease process we treat, particularly peripheral, you know, peripheral arterial disease, especially, is a very morbid and very difficult to treat pathology, regardless of how it manifests on a patient-to-patient basis.
So let's talk a little bit about the kind of vascular disease in general. What attracted you? Why did you become a vascular surgeon?
You know, there's really two reasons that you know, I said, you know what, the long hours, the lifestyle, it's absolutely worth it. You know, the first is, as a vascular surgeon, you get to almost be a bespoke surgeon, for lack of better words. Every patient's different. The field is constantly evolving, and you're doing a lot of routine things, but effectively, each patient you treat gets a one-off surgery. Again, there's gross similarities. We don't make things up. We don't experiment on people. But the combination of treatments and modalities we use is really tailored on an individual basis. The second reason is the patient population. Now, I'll be the first to tell you that society needs more primary care doctors than vascular surgeons, right? The best thing we could do is get people to be healthy. In my case, I'd love for folks to not smoke. But what I like about my job is I can't go back in time and counsel a young, dumb, you know, 20-year-old to not smoke. What I could do is put the browbeating aside and tell folks, you're in a pickle, you're going to have a long road, but let's get you back on the right track. And in the case of peripheral arterial disease, let's save your leg. And that's really meaningful to me, you know, professionally and personally, right? It's very gratifying.
You know, I really like that approach because, okay, here's the problem. Now I'm going to give you a solution. So I could see why it attracted you. Can you talk a little bit about when we talk about vascular surgery? I mean, it's kind of an all-encompassing umbrella. I mean, there's cardiac, peripheral,
yeah.
And then we get into the term endovascular surgery. Can you talk about kind of the differences among those?
Yeah, so vascular surgeons treat all blood vessels outside of the heart and the brain. And we could have, you know, either blockages of the blood vessels or dilation, aneurysms. They don't occur just in the brain is where folks typically get most concerned, but you could have an aneurysm form in any blood vessel in the body. As far as, you know, vascular versus endovascular, as a surgeon, we have every modality at our disposal. You typically think of cardiologists placing stents in the heart and cardiac surgeons doing open heart bypasses. Vascular surgeons are, if you would, a hybrid of those two mindsets. We can do open surgeries to fix blood vessels, but we could also do minimally invasive surgeries and similarly use stents, balloons, catheters, things of that nature in the territories not covered by other specialties, notably the legs.
What would you say is the most common surgery you perform? You've mentioned the legs a couple of times. Is it lower extremity vascular disease?
Yeah, so all comers, the disease process is the same, whether it's the heart, the brain, the legs. On a population level, you know, the most common problem resides in the heart, and the next most common vascular bed to be affected is actually the legs. So peripheral arterial disease is one of the most common diseases we treat in surgeries. Either bypasses or stents and things of that nature are probably one of the more common procedures we do.
Great. This is great to hear. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back. Paul, I got your question. We have a question on statins that I will pose to Dr. Daddario when we come back after the break. We're going to talk about some of the causes of vascular disease and some of the new procedures that are available in our community. If you have questions like Paul, you can reach out to me at info@alessimd.com, and we will pose them to Dr. Daddario while he is with us for the next half hour. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and today we're chatting with Dr. Justin Daddario. Dr. Daddario is an assistant professor of surgery at the University of Connecticut. We're talking about vascular disease. And we're talking before the break a little bit about vascular surgery of the lower extremities. But Justin, what are some of the early symptoms so our listeners might be experiencing to suggest that they have vascular disease affecting their lower extremities?
Yeah, the most common early symptoms for folks with blockages going to their legs is what we call claudication. You know, so folks are very accustomed to ischemic chest pain, angina. You know, you get that tightness in your chest with exertion, and the same process happens in the legs. So if you are using your muscles to the point where they need more blood than they get, you'll actually get cramping in the legs that gets better as soon as you stop either walking, jogging, whatever it is you're doing, and then you quickly resume. And interestingly, because the blockages in your legs are fixed, it's very common that you have a very fixed distance that you can walk before you feel this pain. Now, everyone's different. Everyone has different functional capacity. So if folks have a more sedentary lifestyle, another symptom that we often see is the first sign of arterial disease in the legs is a wound. So if you're not getting enough blood flow to the skin, it makes it difficult to heal any minor abrasions or trauma. And folks will come into the office and say, you know, I've had this wound on my foot for, you know, weeks or months now. And sure enough, they'll have something like non-palpable pulses, and we'll find a insufficient blood flow.
Do we all develop some element of vascular disease as we get older?
Yeah, we do. You know, actually, age is the strongest risk factor for vascular disease. And, you know, unfortunately, that's just a hard and cold fact of life. Everyone will develop hardening of their arteries in some flavor should they live long enough. You know, the trick is to make sure it doesn't accelerate to the point it causes a problem before we die, you know. But we do. We all get blockages at some point.
Other than age and smoking, as you mentioned already, what are some of the other risk factors for peripheral vascular disease?
So the two other big ones that come up, you know, especially in, you know, our population, the U.S. in general, is diabetes. Folks with diabetes have a very specific pattern of disease where the small vessels in their calf and feet will actually get sclerotic or hardened. And then folks with kidney disease, chronic kidney disease, if you've been on dialysis for a number of years, you actually see a similar pattern of disease as people with diabetes. Again, these distal small arteries in the lower leg and foot tend to be the first affected.
When you're looking at this, so one of the things, and Paul's question, might as well bring it up now, was a question about statins. Statins, for the most part, have gotten the worst press of any drug recently in terms of what I feel is an over-exaggeration of the side effects of taking a statin versus the benefit. But, you know, and I'm talking from the standpoint of stroke specifically in the fact that it has been so helpful. But, you know, Paul's question is, you know, he just read a book called Sickening, and obviously it's another one of these books that harps on all the dangers of statins, but yet we're finding statins to be helpful, not just in vascular disease, but across the board. Can you talk a little bit about statins and their pros and cons?
Yeah, and, you know, Paul, I appreciate the question. And to your point, there has been a lot of negative media about statins. You know, the big issues are the myalgias that patients, it's a big quality of life difficulty when you have, you know, thigh or buttock pain from statins. There are some liver side effects. I think we all know that these are transient, you know, elevations in your enzymes that are probably not clinically consequential. But the bad press comes because what becomes an intolerance or what's really, you know, what should be a tapered dose adjustment is often labeled as an allergy, and an allergy that causes debilitating symptoms, which, you know, medically isn't true. Colloquially, yeah, you have a reaction, but it's not anaphylaxis, it's not life-threatening, and we paint it in common parlance as a problem bigger than the benefits, which you can only explain in medical jargon, so it's a little more difficult to get those benefits across. Now, I'd be lying to you if I told you I didn't fight with my own family members about smoking and taking their statins. You know, I'm real salt of the earth kind of guy from upstate in Dutchess County. You know, but the reality is statins are so effective, and you mentioned, you know, cerebrovascular disease and preventing stroke, that for procedures I do as a vascular surgeon on the carotid arteries, we're investigating whether best medical management, statins included, is better than surgery. So to put that in perspective, statins are so good, taking a pill is likely as good, if not better, than opening a blockage to your brain. And I think that's a pretty powerful statement. And the reason for that is, and, you know, Tony, I'm sure you know this as well as anyone else, but regardless of your blood levels, statins stabilize plaques. They prevent ischemic events more than just getting good numbers on paper. And the issue is in our country with medicine, what really should be a long discussion with your provider about maybe starting at a lower dose and increasing as your symptoms subside, or even going to a, you know, PCSK9 inhibitor, which we'll save for another day. You know, in a 7-minute primary care visit, that turns into, I'm having a reaction to statins and we can't use statins on this patient anymore. And that's just unfortunate. But that's the system we work in. But, you know, my ultimate opinion, take your statins. That's the best thing to prevent you from coming into my office, truly and honestly.
Paul, thanks for that question. Justin, so if someone comes to your office with vascular disease, can you walk us to what a typical workup is?
Yeah, so the workup for peripheral arterial disease is actually very, you know, cheap and non-invasive. So anyone that has suspicion of blockages in the legs, we get ankle brachial indices. What this really is, it's a blood pressure cuff on the leg and a blood pressure cuff on the arm, and we compare the two. We determine how much blood is getting down to your foot relative to what we assume to be normal, and it's a pretty safe assumption, to your arms. If that is abnormal, we typically follow it up with either a CAT scan or we could do an angiogram, which is a dye study with a catheter and needle, a percutaneous procedure, just no incisions, but we do stick a needle in and inject some dye. And it all depends on the severity of symptoms and the risk of limb loss, which differentiates that. But just to identify PAD, it's about as quick and easy of a test as you could do. And it's the machine is actually a little goofy. You'll have tubes and blood pressure cuffs all up and down your leg, but it's, you know, nothing zero risk, but this is just about a zero risk diagnostic procedure.
So I have a question here from Barbara, and you might be able to comment on it. Her question is, what are your thoughts on vein stripping? I guess when people have varicose veins and varicosity, so we're switching over to the venous side. What are your thoughts about those? Because there's so many procedures out there, right? Sometimes they heat them up. The old time we would actually use the term stripping, but What are your thoughts on veins?
So, Barbara's terminology, vein stripping, it's a procedure that still exists, but is a little antiquated in terms of standard of care. What she's referring to is in the old days, we'd stick a metal wire rod through the saphenous vein of the leg, tie the vein to it, and just pull it out, actually strip it and remove it out of the body. What we do now for leaking veins in the legs that cause swelling, tenderness, we actually have a multitude of ways to treat them. You know, one of the benefits of being an academic center is we actually have every single way to treat them. But briefly, you can burn the vein, causing it to close up. You can glue the vein shut, which folks ask me what that is, and it's cyanoacrylate. I tell them it's actually medical grade super glue, about as literal as I could get in that regard. And then there's some foams that we can use that destroy the inner lining of the vein and cause it to scar up and prevent the reversal of blood flow.
Are these procedures relatively safe? Because I know I see these vein centers. I mean, for the last 5 or 10 years, we've seen vein centers cropping up all over the place. Is that what they're doing in the vein centers?
Yeah, these kind of procedures? It is, and it's safe medically, but we'll save the private side of medicine for another day. It maybe not so safe for your wallet. These procedures are very benign, but because there is such a heterogeneity in how to treat them, it could often take one or multiple procedures. I typically do them in the office. We take more time to get you in the room and get you set up than actually do the procedure. And they all boil down to a glorified IV with a little bit of numbing medicine, if even that. So they're remarkably safe and remarkably well tolerated.
Are they expensive because they're primarily cosmetic in a lot of cases?
So if they are cosmetic, they could be expensive just because it's not covered by insurance. The unfortunate part about the business of medicine is you could approach veins in a way that minimizes the chance of needing a procedure in the future or maximizes the chance of needing a procedure in the future.
Gotcha. What
I tell folks, a lot of folks have varicose veins in the calf and a leaking vein in the thigh. There's two ways you could approach this. You could say, I'll treat the vein in the thigh and I'll take the varicose veins out in the calf. My approach is to just treat the thigh because a majority of patients won't need that second procedure. Again, six of one, half dozen of the other. I just prefer a minimalist approach myself.
Sure. Obviously, that's great. I want to get on to angioplasty. So you brought up the carotid artery. And,
yeah.
And, carotid treatment has gone, I've lived through it since the 80s, right? So we did endarterectomies. Then we did bypasses, right? Then we found bypasses didn't work. And then I guess as if you live long enough, you don't throw away your wide ties because we're back to bypasses. We did angioplasty, and that didn't work for a while. But now I just had a patient who had a one-day angioplasty of their carotid. They had a tight carotid just at one location. They were symptomatic. A surgeon went in, angioplastied it, and they did wonderfully. So can you talk a little bit about carotid angioplasty and maybe the evolution of carotid artery treatment?
Yeah, this is a very hot field, and as you alluded to, it evolves almost daily. So the gold standard procedure for blockages in the carotid artery is an endarterectomy. What that means is we make a traditional incision, we scoop out the plaque, and then we close the artery and allow blood flow to be restored. The reason that's safe is we could physically prevent blood clots from traveling up to the brain. When you place a stent or place a balloon, at some point you have to cross the blockage before you could open it up. And as you cross that blockage, if you break something off, well, the end of that road leads to the brain, and that's where we have a stroke risk. So to be fair, vascular surgeons like the procedures they like, and we like open surgery. angioplasty, there is a higher stroke risk, but if you needed something done, it's still a very safe procedure. What we have now is called a transcarotid artery revascularization. It kind of marries the best of both worlds. We make a small incision at the base of the neck, and I'll save you the technical jargon, but it's almost like sci-fi. We reverse blood flow to the brain, so blood leaves the carotid artery and comes through a little filter, and we place a stent that way. After we place the stent, and there's no risk of causing a stroke, we flip a switch, so to speak, and send the blood flow back to the brain. There are some rare pathologies, you know, fibromuscular dysplasia, an inflammation of the blood vessel wall that's a little less common. That could be very well treated with just a balloon, but those would be the minority of patients.
That's fascinating. And honestly, I didn't know about that procedure. So that's very instructive for all of us, the way that's developed. So let's talk a little bit more about angioplasty. When we talk about lower extremities, let's get back to the lower extremities.
Yeah.
We're all familiar or maybe familiar with the femoral popliteal bypass procedure, common procedure for insufficient circulation to the lower extremities. Can you talk about the evolution of treatment for that?
Yeah, so this is, you know, very interesting. In my training, the paradigm's actually switched. You know, the core of the problem in treating blockages in the femoral arteries, the artery in the thigh, is there is a slight risk of stroke, death, and heart attack just by getting general anesthesia and having a vascular procedure. However, if you do something minimally invasive, like place a stent or use a balloon, you avoid that risk, but that is generally not as durable as a traditional open procedure. And we've come to the point where when I started my training, it was, wow, endovascular is so low risk, everyone gets a stent first. And then it turned out that bypasses lasted so long, you wound up having to do less procedures, and it was actually lower risk over the long term. So we're at a point now where we know if we could avoid surgical risk but get you the equivalent of a bypass, that's probably the best of all worlds. Now, there's a device that I'm going to be using here in a short while. It just became commercially available. We'll be the first in New England to offer this service commercially. And it eventually marries the ability to perform a traditional bypass but doesn't require open incisions or general anesthetic. And that is just a game changer as far as I'm concerned. And I think the field is going to move towards these kind of modalities being the standard.
So how successful is that? I mean, obviously, is it, when you say it's a game changer, has it really been as successful as doing the open procedure?
So it surprisingly has come alarmingly close if you're a bread and butter open surgeon. What this procedure has shown, and we have about 2 year results now, is that we measure bypasses in terms of patency, how long they stay open. You have a procedure that is as likely to stay open as doing a traditional surgery with a piece of prosthetic. And the reason why I find that very enticing for my patients is we know the risk is from having a heart complication with surgery. We don't have to be better at restoring blood flow than an open surgery. We have to approach the level of open surgery while decreasing the risk of the procedure. And as far as we know, based on the data we have, we got 2 year outcomes results. This procedure comes alarmingly close to traditional surgery, and we could do it without giving any general anesthetic, without making any incisions, and even getting people home the same day or after a one night stay.
Another question that came in, and it was a question I had as well. Do you still use vasodilating medications? Now, I remember with claudication, we would use a variety of drugs that, yeah, that resulted in opening up arteries or dilating arteries. Do you still use that as a preliminary step to surgery?
We do. So for folks that can tolerate their symptoms to the point where it's just a nuisance but not something that's, you know, inhibiting their ability to go about their business, we try just about everything we can to avoid surgery. The two agents that are being referred to are pentoxyphylline, you know, commonly known as tretol, and celostazol, known as pletol. Now, the common thought is, are they very effective? No, they're not the most effective medications, but they are incredibly benign. So as a first step, I will instruct folks to make some lifestyle modifications. We've talked about the smoking.
Sure.
Get them to exercise to condition their muscles to use the blood supply they have, and I'll start something like a vasodilator such as celostazol.
In closing, I guess, what's one thing our listeners need to know about vascular surgery? What's either the next big thing coming, or what's one thing that they wouldn't commonly know from reading the paper or listening to the radio or on that you can let us in on?
Yeah, I'll say there's a lot of folks that treat vascular disease outside of vascular surgeons. And the reality is if you have access to more than one expert, more than one train of thought, you know, I would recommend getting as much input as you can. I'm obviously biased towards vascular surgeons, being one myself, but the way I see it is the field is changing so fast, we can't keep up with it ourselves. Yeah, you know, to be quite frank, that's just the rate of progress we see. So your best chance at getting the safest, most effective procedure is probably from someone that could do all of the procedures. You know, there's places out in the Midwest where I came from where the idea is just get them a physician, period. We don't really have that problem here in Connecticut.
Sure.
So truly, I feel for some patients that get sent around the ringer and through the medical landscape referred over and over and over. But this is a pretty serious problem, and you got to get a lot of information if you have the luxury of time. And that's something I think most folks don't appreciate, not in the field.
Justin, thank you. Thank you for your time today, and thank you for spending time with us today on Healthy Rounds. For folks who want to reach out to Dr. Daddario, his office phone number is 860-679-8080. Justin, thanks again.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
We're going to take a short break, then we'll be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. Many thanks to Dr. Daddario for spending time with us. Many thanks to our studio producer, Kevin Kors, who's been on the board today. Jeff Chandler's always in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week, I will be on the road, so we're going to play an interview I did in the past with Dr. DeMarchida. A lot of people have had a lot of questions for me about Parkinson's disease, and she gave us such a great interview. I think it was back in November or early December. So we're going to replay that, but I will have updated information for everybody in the first segment of the show. If you missed any part of today's program and the interview with Dr. Daddario, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast by downloading it at Odyssey.com or go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. It's free of charge. If you have questions for me during the week, just go to info@AlessiMD.com. Shoot me over an email. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with Attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.